The following is a rebroadcast of a forum originally aired in April of 2017. This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. I'm Christian Camargo. For as much social progress as American society has seemingly made over the last many decades, why do racial, ethnic, gender, and class disparities linger in our society? It's a topic that confounds many, and it's not easily discussed, or perhaps it's not discussed enough. But today, we will. In the spring of 2017, the Hinckley Institute of Politics hosted another series of campus community dialogues with the theme of understanding our differences and shaping our future. The title of this forum, Diversity and Disparity, Race, Class, and Gender Inequities in the U.S. This event was recorded back on April 20th, 2017, and sponsored by the College of Social and Behavioral Science, Hinckley Institute of Politics, Department of Political Science, as well as the Undergraduate and Graduate Student Advisory Councils. This forum was moderated by Catherine Bond Stockton, the Associate Vice President for Equity and Diversity at the University of Utah. The panelists, who Dr. Stockton will introduce, include Justice Christine Durham, who at the time was a justice on the Utah Supreme Court, she has since retired, Ron Gordon, Executive Director of the Utah Commission on Criminal and Juvenile Justice, Claudia Geist, Assistant Professor with the Gender Studies and Sociology Department at the University of Utah, Professor Gonzalez Barrick with the Department of Economics at the University of Utah, and Professor Edmund Fong in the Political Science and Ethnic Studies Departments, also at the University of Utah. Here's Associate Vice President for Equity and Diversity, Catherine Bond Stockton.
I am thrilled to be here. Get your disagreement juices roiling, all right? We want to hear from you. I also want to say you get about 100 sweetness points from me for being here on April 20th, this point in the semester. So this is commitment. This is intellectual commitment, and I like how it feels. Here are today's essential questions for our dialogue. From wage gaps and sketchy employment practices to criminal justice and political representation, what explains the pernicious hanging on of racial, ethnic, and gender disparities in U.S. society? How can we secure equal justice for all international scene? Or boil it down, what's unfair? Why is it unfair? Now, let me make a quick point. Mark asked if I would just give a few moments of thoughts here. I guess I want to say I'm a theorist, English professor, as you know. I would say not only do we suffer from outright disparities, we're going to be talking about those are palpable, but we also suffer from the ways we frame disparities, and I think from our dubious solutions to disparities. So let me briefly illustrate. What if we were to say, as I do believe early second wave feminists were always saying, women suffer from staying at home, from being kept from work. That was one of those key early feminist thoughts, that women were sort of prisoners in their home and we need to free them so they can go into the labor force. Hopefully you are asking, was that a bad framing of a question? It certainly was a partial framing of a question, which maybe makes it a bad framing, which is to say, many feminists of color immediately began to call out and say, that framing does not work for us. Many women of color, working class women, immigrant women, were always working outside of their homes. They did not have the luxury of that exploitation. And therefore, this framing of the problem, if it did not confess its partiality, was kind of a bad framing and missed this important racialization. Now, there were also bras. Say what? We're talking about bras? We are, all right? Let me give you an example of a dubious solution to this partial framing. I study ads and advertising, or did it one time, and what I began to notice is there were a lot of bra ads that started to kick up in the early 1980s and running through the 80s that seemed to be addressed to women who were going into the workforce, particularly in corporate jobs, professorships, law firms, kind of addressing women's worry that they would be losing their femininity as they moved into these male domains. And you can track that in bra ads. As you probably know, Victoria's Secret began in 1977, all right? Here's one of my favorites, and I'll just give this to you because we should have some comic relief on such a serious topic. This is a beautiful bra ad from 1987, all right? This is for the Bright Lines bra from Vanity Fair, all right? And here's how the copy reads. So you can see that woman, she's in her bra, she's got her houndstooth skirt on her lap, pearls, looking fairly professional, and she's saying this, "Is this suit corporate enough? These shoes are a pain. Job interviews. This new bra sure fits. It's so comfortable. I'm right for this job because, no, I'm perfect. Hire me or else." The confidence is coming from the bra. That's an amazing feat, it seems to me, and a misunderstanding, a dubious solution to our problems. Nonetheless, that type of ad range was very prominent in that time. All right, now let's get to serious things. Let's introduce our speakers. Would it be permissible to call her legal treasure? If not, sue me. We treasure Justice Durham for her service to our state. Since 1982, with degrees from Duke and Wellesley, she served on the Utah Supreme Court, including a 10-year stint as Chief Justice and Chair of the Utah Judicial Council. He, to her left, has handled the trickiest matter in our state, holding degrees from BYU and Utah. How does he do it? Especially when he has a truly tricky job. Ron Gordon, that is, our second speaker, has been serving as the executive director of the Utah Commission on Criminal and Juvenile Justice since 2009. Try saying three times, she studies comparative social stratification. Claudia Geis can say it four times, because she's cool, or because she is an assistant professor in sociology and gender studies, where she works on topics like racial differences and young adults dating rituals. But save some intellectual love for feminist economics, particularly in the hands of Gwenceli Barrick. Dr. Barrick is professor of economics and affiliated faculty member of the Asian Studies program here at the U. If I understood economics just a bit better, I could make up fancy alternative facts. Alas, I don't, so I'm forced to tell the truth. Dr. Barrick is the bomb when it comes to development and labor economics. Finally, after hacking elections in Ogden with microwave ovens, alternative fact, Edmund Fong became associate professor of political science and ethnic studies at the U of U. He says his interests are critical race studies and contemporary political theory, and I, for one, believe him, since I've heard him say smart things about both. That's our panel. Let's begin. Justice Durham.
Thank you for the introduction. For your remarks, I'm struck by your comment about the advertising connected with women's undergarments. I looked at one of the local papers online this morning and I saw a story in which a program devoted to developing leadership in young women managed to get itself some, I think, very bad press because of its prescription of a dress code for the high school girls who participate in that program. They are required to wear skirts and blouses. Some of us were wondering when was the last time we heard reference to a blouse, but apparently they're still around at Girls State, and dresses. And what struck me, not simply the fact that this was outdated and somewhat antique, but that it was all about telling women what they had to wear and how they had to look. So those ads go back to the 80s, but those issues are still very much with us. They overlap into so much of our culture, and it's something to keep in mind. That is a good segue into my remarks and my experience, because I come out of an era. I graduated from college in the late 60s. I used to joke, I started college in the 50s and finished in the 70s because there was enormous cultural change going on, and the second wave of feminism was in fact gaining momentum. I want to start out by pointing out that I'm a little bit out of my element in this kind of a dialogue, because judges don't generally deal with policy. We deal with law. And the contours of our concept of fairness tend to be circumscribed by constitutions and statutes. And you'll read a lot of judicial opinions where we say we don't get to decide what's fair and good policy. We have to comply with what the legislature has decided is fair and good policy in the statutory context and in what the framers of our state and federal constitutions have decided comprises fairness. But the other thing I'd like to point out is that there's a degree to which the definition of fairness is part of the identity of a judge. And let me tell you, over the years, as I have worked in judicial education, focusing on gender and ethnic fairness in the courts, it's a huge hurdle to start talking about bias with judges, because no judge is comfortable with the notion that he or she may have biases, implicit or explicit. So that's just kind of an introduction. First part of our question is, why do we have these enormous disparities in American society, well in now, decade and a half into the 21st century? My reasons are going to sound like everyone else's reasons, so going first, perhaps I'll set some of the vocabulary, at least, or the basis for our discussion. I think that racism, sexism, and stereotypical assumptions about differences including religion, for example, and disability, and I'm talking are in fact embedded in our culture, embedded in our history, embedded in our vocabulary, and embedded in our experience. And I speak as someone who's been in the battles for over 40 years. So we've made a lot of progress. We've changed a lot of laws. We've changed some constitutions. We've passed a lot of laws. But I still think that you have these embedded problems. But I want to emphasize that they're both, that I'm making reference to both explicit, and frankly, we've seen that there's more explicit racism, sexism, et cetera, out there in our culture than perhaps we wanted to believe. It seems to have been permitted in public discourse, given what happened in the last electoral cycle, in a way that it hasn't been considered socially acceptable for some period of time. But I'm also very committed to understand the degree to which many of us who don't want to be racist or sexist nonetheless have to deal with the fact that, like every human being, we are a product of what we have absorbed from our culture, from our families, from our society since the time of our birth. We've been reading those ads and watching them on television all of our lives. And so the problem of implicit assumptions and implicit biases is very significant. So that's one thing, I think. The other thing, I think, is that you really have institutional embodiments of the historical realities in many of our institutions. The institutions which make up the criminal justice system, our educational system, our politics, our attitudes towards power and towards money are all infused with these kinds of attitudes that we have, some of which we don't even realize we have. And there's a huge lack of consensus around the causation of the disparities that we see and the need for redressing them. I don't know if any of you saw it last night. I think it was either Trevor Noah or Stephen Colbert, that'll give you an idea of my late night viewing. We're doing a retrospective on Mr. O'Reilly, who just left his job at Fox News. And they had a lot of vignettes about comments he had made on the air that were unbelievably racist and sexist. I mean, one in which he called a respected black professor and journalist, told him he looked like a drug dealer. Another of which he commented on going to a black-owned restaurant and was surprised at how civilized it all was and that nobody was running around being crazy in it. I mean, those I think are in the explicit category. Imagine what's in the implicit category. The other things that I think about why these things are still endemic have to do with fear. And fear in the sense of fear of change and loss. I had a wonderful experience attending a session on leadership at the Kennedy Institute a number of years ago. It was for judicial leaders. And we read a book by a professor called Heifetz, who talked about the fact that when you are asking human beings to change their thinking, to change their behavior, you are asking them to do a very painful thing. You're asking them to let go of a system that works for them, to let go of assumptions that have been meaningful to them, to let go of their sense of who they are and how they fit in the world. And when I encountered that work, I remembered I remembered an occasion many, many years ago when we were organizing Women Lawyers of Utah, and we invited the all-male, all-white leaders of the Utah State Bar to a breakfast to talk to us about our concerns. And at one point, the then president of the bar stood up and he said, I don't get it. I love my wife. I love my daughters. What is it you ladies want? And I remember we hissed him off the stage. We were not very polite. And I look back now and I realize that the anger we felt was inadequately empathetic to what we were asking of him. What we wanted from him was to change and to conceivably give up some of the power that he possessed in our particular professional system. That was a huge ask. And then, of course, I think we're lacking in political will. My time, I think. Oh, you're
that
here.
Was good.
How
yes.
am I doing?
You're great. Do you want to just make one last point,
yes,
and then
I just wanted
move
to deal gently, lightly, with the second part of the question of what we can do about it. I used to think that if you just educated everybody, if you just told them what the facts are and what the logic of the facts were, they would change their minds. Has anybody had good luck with that? Not so much. I think that it's important for us to identify and use incentives of other kinds. I still believe in education. I believe very strongly, I think Ron might want to deal with this, with the notion of evidence-based practices, of creating objective systems where we can avoid the kinds of implicit assumptions and attitudes and stereotypes that we all carry around willy-nilly and rely on data. I think those are useful. And then finally, and I think that goes to the organization of things like this dialogue, and that is to create more spaces that are safe in our communities and in our lives for people who carry around very different sets of assumptions and experience to come together and to share what they learn from those. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Okay.
That's then Utah Supreme Court Justice Christine Durham, speaking as part of a forum on race, class, and gender inequities in the U.S., recorded in April of 2017 at the Hinckley Institute of Politics. And you were listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. For podcasts, more local shows, and lectures, follow us on iTunes or visit the Local Shows tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to keep local programming alive on KCPW.
Welcome back to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Christian Camargo. On this program, as you might already know, we record and broadcast many engaging lectures, debates, and panel discussions held at the Hinckley Institute of Politics, and we replay them, mostly unedited, as a public service. And today, we are airing a forum recorded in April of 2017 in which addresses racial, gender, and class disparities in the U.S. This forum was moderated by Catherine Bond Stockton, the Associate Vice President for Equity and Diversity at the University of Utah. The panelists include now-retired Utah Supreme Court Justice Christine Durham, Professor Claudia Geis with the Gender Studies and Sociology Departments at the University of Utah, Professor Gonzalez Barrick with the Department of Economics at the University of Utah, Professor Edmund Fong in the Political Science and Ethnic Studies Departments at the University of Utah, and to speak next, Ron Gordon, Executive Director of the Utah Commission on Criminal and Juvenile Justice.
When I was a third-year law student, I took a state constitutional law class from Justice Durham. I didn't care at all about state constitutional law at the time. I just thought, if you have a chance to take a class from Justice Durham, you should do it. So two things. One, it was absolutely as incredible of an experience as I thought it would be. And I do really appreciate principles of state constitutional law now. So you did. You changed my mind. You showed me principles. You changed my mind. Let me build on some of the things that Justice Durham mentioned. My experience and expertise comes primarily in the criminal justice system and in our juvenile justice system, and in assisting with judicial appointments and then seeing what it takes to remain on the bench, or what happens when somebody who is on the bench acts with a certain kind of demeanor. So we see these implicit biases that Justice Durham was talking about evident all throughout every system, every institution, and definitely within our criminal justice system. We see institutions that were built by the majority for the majority. We see policing practices that have been developed by the majority. And let's assume for a moment that they're all built and established with the best of intentions. Let's assume that for a minute. They're still built with implicit biases. They're still built with certain cultural assumptions that, one, probably just shouldn't be there at all, and two, just are not, they're not transferable. They don't relate. We see this issue of evidence-based practices be very helpful and also maybe add to the problem sometimes. So a couple of examples. Let me talk first about a judicial appointment issue. You might see a woman who is on the bench display a certain type of demeanor and be evaluated very differently than a man who is on the bench and displays exactly the same type of demeanor. Why? Because of cultural expectations, because of implicit biases, that it is good and appropriate for men to be very strong and firm, and that when a woman is strong and firm, she's mean. That might not be how it's always articulated, but that's how it's viewed in large part. So some people are at a disadvantage because of these cultural expectations and these biases that every single one of us have, but often we're really nervous about confronting, and that's why one of the reasons why they continue is because it's really uncomfortable and unnerving and sometimes embarrassing to confront them. So Justice Durham and I have a shared experience. We both have taken at least one of the online Harvard University implicit bias tests. I did it while I was preparing for a book club discussion with all of the members of the Utah Supreme Court and Court of Appeals. We were talking about Michelle Alexander's book, The New Jim Crow. I took an implicit bias test on race, and so it compared Caucasian faces with African American faces, and it associated positive adjectives with those faces and negative adjectives with those faces. And then it would instruct me to press a certain key to indicate that a Caucasian face was good or an African American face was good. And then the opposite, press a certain key to indicate that an African American face was bad or a Caucasian face was bad. So I'm taking this test, and to be perfectly honest, while I'm taking it, I'm thinking to myself, I am nailing this. I love everybody equally. I don't have this. You know, I'm nailing this test. And then I finish the test, and then it says to me, you show a slight preference for Caucasian faces. And by the way, did I say it times your response? So the face will come up with the word, and it times how long it takes you to press the right button. So it tells me this. You show a slight preference for Caucasian faces, and the initial reactions were embarrassment, and I was really unnerved and uncomfortable, and part of me thought, I'm going to take it again. I'm going to take it again. Something's wrong with the test. And then, for at least a week or two after, I'm driving around Salt Lake City. I see a Caucasian person, and I force myself to think, there's probably something sketchy about that person. I see a person of color, and I force myself to think, come on over, best person in Salt Lake, I love. Well, that's not helpful either, right? I mean, that's not the point of taking the test, but it is one of the reasons why these things continue, because it's very, very difficult. An area where evidence-based practices is good and sometimes contributes to the cause, let's take something like hotspot policing. Evidence shows us that when we direct our police resources to areas where crime is most likely to occur and where it is occurring most frequently, that we catch the people who are committing the crimes. That's what the evidence shows. And so when we direct our police resources in those areas where we see higher crime rates, then we are more likely to catch people who are committing these crimes. Or is it the fact that wherever we direct our resources, we are more likely to catch people who are committing crimes because we catch people when we monitor them? That's also evidence-based. We find violations of people who are being supervised. Why? Because we're monitoring them. And sometimes because they're really bad violations, but in large part because we're monitoring them. And so wherever we direct our resources, we'll find things. And so it's not just that they actually are criminal hotspots, it's that we're there and we're watching. And if a hotspot is a neighborhood with a lot of people of color, then we begin to think, wow, all of the crime is taking place in this neighborhood with a lot of people of color. And criminal hotspots equate with neighborhoods where a lot of people of color reside. And that's actually not what the evidence is saying, but it's what can be very easy to come to think in our minds. And so we have to be really careful about implementation of those practices. One other thing I'll mention that I think is applicable in criminal justice, probably any field, and that is it's easy for a lot of people to think that we've achieved our success without any benefit from society. We've achieved our success just by working really hard. And I didn't need benefits from society. I didn't need any favors. And of course, we know that that's not true, right? Yeah. Justice Durham just mentioned white privilege. Because nobody attains success without assistance, without some kind of privilege, without some kind of benefit, without some kind of assist along the way. And we certainly see all of these things playing out in the field where I practice as well.
That's Ron Gordon, Executive Director of the Utah Commission on Criminal and Juvenile Justice. Speaking next is Professor Claudia Geist, Assistant Professor with the Gender Studies and Sociology Departments at the University of Utah.
Sometimes when I tell people that I study gender inequality, they really look for easy answers. And often I disappoint people because I don't tell people evil oppression is happening all the time, and that's the only reason that we see existing inequalities. Now, of course, there is a lot of oppression. There is a lot of discrimination. And my expertise lies more in the area of gender inequality. But even though sometimes I secretly think, wouldn't it be easy if we could just blame some easy thing, and then, you know, then we some magically get rid of it, and then everything would be fine. But unfortunately, it's really not that easy. And so discrimination happens. Discrimination is real. Sometimes it's explicit. Sometimes it may be due to implicit assumptions and implicit discrimination. But what I find is just as hard to address is that, you know, sometimes we find that women behave differently than men, especially when it comes to the workforce. And people are very quick to point, it's like, look, people just choose to work part-times. People choose to work in these low-paying jobs, and if they just behave differently, like not have children, not get married, choose different majors, like why you're not a STEM major, that if people just behave differently, we would not see gaps of any kind. But I want to point out that the choices that we make are constrained choices. I mean, yes, I do believe that we can make some choices. We're not like predetermined, our life is not like pre-programmed. But what we see as possibilities, like the choices among which we choose, are limited. So for example, a young girl who is just terribly uncomfortable in skirts or dresses may not go to that really like great leadership camp that tells them to become like awesome leaders. You know, the issue of whether anybody wants to like really long-term work in the service industry notwithstanding, yesterday I went to a restaurant where it said, please wait for hostess to seat you. Now, oftentimes exclusion happens for women, and we see male role models, very few women in positions, but the same goes for men. Like this idea that we assume men or women are good at one thing or another really doesn't just limit men, it also excludes men from certain professions, like early childhood education, and you know other careers that are seen as more feminine. And so I am very wary of sort of the blaming of people who don't behave in the right ways, don't choose the right major, or have the right kind of life course because they choose to do so. I mean, it does not happen in a vacuum. One of the additional things that really complicate, especially when we look at gender inequalities, is that gender is multidimensional and headache-inducingly complicated. In that there is not, gender is not a binary. And although many survey boxes would lead you to believe the opposite, there are other aspects of gender that also matter. That even if you fall neatly in one of those binary boxes, there is the idea of sexuality, that, if you even are in a privileged position with respect to gender, gay men have severe disadvantages in the labor market in terms of wage gaps. There's gender identity. I don't have to tell you that trans and gender nonconforming individuals have a very hard time in any aspect of life, let alone employment and employment security, or even physical safety. But even subtle things like gender expression, this idea of dress codes, makeup mandates, what's considered appropriate hair, hairstyles, the assumptions people make about you makes it so much more layered, and that sometimes we omit some privileges that straight white women have, and some of the layered multiple disadvantages that gender minorities, sexual minorities, especially of color, really face. And so that makes it more complicated to just say, oh, there's just one group of victims and one group of the bad guys. The solution part of those fundamental questions is, of course, a little bit more complicated, since, let's just fundamentally change how we approach gender and categories in society, and then we'll all be fine. But that is just not quite as easy. One of the intermediary steps could be to maybe not assume quite as much about people based on when you first meet them. Just because somebody is openly identifies as a woman does not mean that she has plans to have children, lots of them, and wants to get married and has family as a priority. Nor is the opposite the case if you have somebody who maybe identifies even as a straight white male. Maybe that person really, at heart, really wants to prioritize family. But even subtle things where institutions can make a difference, when do you schedule events? Do you tacitly assume that there is a partner at home who takes care of any dependents? Or do you assume that people have spouses, maybe of the opposite sex? It's just tiny things that, as a pragmatist, maybe little things can feel people more included. Asking for pronouns, to just have a more inclusive environment. And as many University of Utah emails often emphasize, the inclusive excellence can be promoted in many different levels, and then perhaps that creates a larger, more inclusive environment.
That's Professor Claudia Geist, Assistant Professor with the Gender Studies and Sociology Departments at the University of Utah. If you're just joining us today, it's a rebroadcast of a forum originally aired in April of 2017, taking a look at racial, gender, and class disparities in the U.S. And you were listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. For podcasts, more local shows, and lectures, follow us on iTunes or visit the Local Shows tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to keep local programming alive on KCPW.
This is Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. I'm Christian Camargo. Today, we are bringing you another series of campus community dialogues with the theme of understanding our differences, shaping our future. The title of this forum, Diversity and Disparity: Race, Class, and Gender Inequities in the U.S. This forum was recorded back in April of 2017 and moderated by Associate Vice President for Equity and Diversity, Catherine Bond-Stockton. Speaking next is Professor Gunzelli Barrick with the Department of Economics at the University of Utah.
I'm delighted to be here. I will, I guess, revert back to the binary, gender as binary, because our most of our statistics are collected on the basis of man-woman binary. But I think we can get pretty far ahead with even talking about the binary. It is that time of the year when we get the latest installment of our gender wage gap. And in this time around, that figure is 80%. And that means essentially median earnings of full-time year-round employed women are 80% of their male counterparts. And in the case of Utah, that figure is 71%. 71. And so we have a gap of 29 cents on the dollar or 20 cents on the dollar nationally. And in Utah, that 71% is the third worst in the US currently. And we have kind of been around that area for a while now. I believe that the gender gap, gender wage gap, is a starting point for our public conversation on what kind of society we would like to strive for and would like to live in. And I contend that reducing the gender wage gap is an important part of moving toward a more inclusive, fair, and productive society. So it's an efficiency issue as well as a fairness issue. I would like to start with some good news. That 80% figure represents enormous progress from the late 70s when it was 60%. Mm-hmm. Women earned 60% full-time year-round employed women earned 60% of what their male counterparts earned. And this progress has been the outcome of two things which kind of feed into that measure. Obviously, women's earnings have increased, but also men's earnings have stagnated over this period of time. And that has to do with the effects of globalization and changing job structures in the US, which led to disproportionate loss of good paying jobs for men. And so that we have that stagnant male wages and then rising female wages. Well, what underlies the rising female wages? Women have increased their qualifications. Their education levels have risen, their attachment to the labor force, their work experience has risen, and they have moved into professional occupations in greater numbers where they were previously almost absent entirely. And so that's the progress, but when we look at the latest statistical analysis of what accounts for the persistence of the gender wage gap, which is now much smaller, but what accounts for it? The sources boil down to two main things. One is the occupational and industrial employment of differences between women and men, namely women being concentrated in lower paying occupations and industries compared to men. And secondly, second major component is the I guess discrimination is the shorthand, employer bias, if we want to put it more softly. But essentially, it's differential pay for comparable qualifications. So those are our two main components. And if we look at, for example, for the first one, for the first component, if we look at Utah, the latest figures show that almost 50% of our full-time, year-round employed, I'm not even talking about part-time, part-year jobs. Women in this very relatively homogeneous category, 50% of them are employed in three occupations: administrative and office support, teaching, and sales. And these generate lower pay compared to what men earn in the top three occupations for men. Now in Utah, which is distinct from US, we have an additional problem that contributes to the gender wage gap, and that is the educational gap. The college graduation unfortunately lags behind men. And then, as for the lower pay for comparable qualifications with men, now typical sources of such practice, I mean, sometimes we kind of are like appalled that this could be happening, you know, that unfair, you know, assignment of wages is taking place. But typically, and you know, just check with your own anecdotal, you know, evidence, typically this happens when employers essentially presume the man deserves a breadwinner wage and woman is only a supplementary earner. Or it could be that there's a presumption that young women will, you know, end up becoming mothers and will have less commitment to the workforce. And so these are the types of assumptions that lead to lower pay for equal work. And then, of course, the statistical analysis, you know, this sort of two main contributors, also raises further questions. And the questions are, why are women concentrated in these lower paying jobs to begin with? And in Utah, for Utah, we can also ask, why are women less likely to graduate college? And I guess I'll kind of piggyback on what Professor Geist earlier pointed out. This constrained choices issue is very relevant, of course. There are gender norms. What are appropriate jobs for women and men is one consideration when you're choosing your college major. Feedback from the labor market. Are the male-dominated STEM occupations, high-tech occupations, or even construction occupations, are they welcoming, mentoring, or hostile? These, of course, are going to influence where you want to end up in. And thirdly, institutional supports. Are there supports for working parents to combine family and paid work? And so these all essentially constrain opportunities of women.
That was Professor Gonzalez Barrick with the Department of Economics at the University of Utah. And speaking next is Professor Edmund Fong with the Political Science and Ethnic Studies departments, also at the University of Utah.
So I just want to start by saying what a pleasure and honor it is to be invited and be a part of this distinguished panel. We were sort of asked two essential questions. One is about, you know, what accounts for persistent racial disparities in the U.S. and, you know, what must be done to secure equal justice for all in American society. I don't have too much to add in terms of what accounts for persistent racial disparities from what many of the commentators have already said. I agree with many of them. What has been mentioned about, you know, the role of implicit bias and persistent stereotypes. One thing I would sort of stress out of that is that these are things that leave a sediment over time, right? They structure American society in terms of its norms, rules, institutions, right? So it's not just about an individual's attitudes, but how they leave a trace, right? Leave a trace across time that, you know, structures the behavior of other people well beyond the particular individuals involved. In terms of what must be done, the question we were posed was, you know, what might be a kind of underlying principle that might guide constructive dialogue around tackling some of these persistent disparities? I think the one thing that I would stress, especially in light of our recent election cycle, is a commitment to cultivating public memory using or based in historical truth. Cultivating public memory based in historical truth. One of the most distressing things I think many of you share is in the recent election cycle is the large-scale influence of alternative facts, fake news, partisan narratives. You know, coming from the standpoint as a scholar of racial politics, this is especially problematic because when we're thinking about racial discrimination and inequality across American history, one of the things that, you know, we as scholars always confront is the long-term and deep consequences of a dishonest cultivation of American history for public memory. For almost a century after slavery's end, false narratives about slavery warped the minds of Americans, enabling a collective disavowal and amnesia of its impact and importance. right? Again, so it's not just about the individuals at any point in time and whatever attitudes they or perspectives they might have had, but the long-term structured sort of consequence of this, right? So-called fake news are not just an aspect of our particular present, but weave past and future together, crippling our honest engagement with the past, limiting our future possibilities as well. Stereotypes and false narratives harden into implicit bias, shaping our practices whether we realize it or not. Critically understanding patterns and practices that cause past and present disparities empower us to recognize their legacies, consider them beyond the pale. Equal justice by itself is an empty principle without being informed by the particularities of past and present realities. That, to me, is what cultivating public memory is about, and it has to be cultivated. Right? Developing a fount of public memory that informs us about the past in ways that help us guide, or in ways that help guide us to what should be important for all of us, a collective we. So I want to try to stress kind of why that is important, for me at least, in three more concrete ways, talking about disparities in criminal justice and law, law and order, talking about the racial wealth gap that has been getting more and more attention in the last few decades, and then talking about our current climate around voting rights, right? Or as many people seem to suggest, a sort of climate of voter suppression efforts. Right? All right, criminal justice and law and order. So with the evolving Trump administration, we clearly see a kind of return to a harsh law and order rhetoric, right? And so I think this is a case in point where cultivating a kind of public memory based in historical truth really sort of matters, right? Violent crime remains currently near the bottom of the nation's 30-year downward trend. That's from recent statistics that put out by the Brennan Center for Justice. 2015, although 2015 and 2016 witnessed an increase in the murder rate, that much of this was localized in cities like Baltimore, Chicago, Washington, D.C. But again, in the long-term view of things, historical memory, we are in the midst of a downturn, 30-year downturn in crime rates. There is thus no widespread, quote-unquote, American carnage, as President Trump has argued in his State of the Union address. Current predictions for this year, 2016, are a 3.3% violent crime projection, a slightly larger increase, 14% in the murder rate from 2015. But again, these sort of increased statistics are largely driven by a few cities, a spike in places like Baltimore and Chicago. Now, in addition to this, discriminatory treatment of African Americans by the criminal justice system is widely well known. It has led to 1.5 million missing black men, according to a New York Times report last year. The main driver of those missing were black men incarcerated. The largest gap between black men and women was found in Ferguson, Missouri. There's a 37.5% gap between the numbers of black men and women in a place in Ferguson, Missouri. So this is a public, social, and economic catastrophe that has far-reaching consequences for all of us, however we wish to moralize or politicize the issue. So you put that aside in also a building reform effort of criminal justice and mass incarceration that has become a bipartisan collective effort, and you set that aside again into this sort of climate under the Trump administration. For example, Attorney General Jeff Sessions has recently indicated the Department of Justice would not investigate police departments, would review all existing consent decrees, and in the Q&A I can talk more about that, what that is if you are interested, and has essentially articulated a policy not to, quote-unquote, intrude into the practices of local police. This is calamitous for cultivating public memory, precisely because it was primarily through a Department of Justice investigation of the Ferguson Police Department that we learned of discriminatory and predatory practices upon the predominantly African-American community. Things like racial profiling stops, despite lower criminal arrest rates for African Americans in Ferguson, Missouri. More arrest warrants issued in Ferguson than there were actual residents in Ferguson. Multiple stacking of fines and fees on those who were issued arrest warrants or civil violations, all for the purpose of increasing the city's finances. Right? We learned about these things only in the course of a Department of Justice investigation of the Ferguson Police Department. So essentially, Attorney General Sessions wishes to put collective blinders on the practice of law enforcement and retreat from the DOJ's responsibility as a source of critical oversight and leverage. In the long durée of civil rights history, the role of the federal government as a key watchdog for rights deprivations of racial minorities cannot be overstated. That's a key sort of pattern that we learn from collective memory across civil rights history. And that is something that is being sort of short-circuited, at least with this evolving approach under the Trump administration. Right. How am I doing on... I'm at my time. Okay. So I wanted to talk about racial wealth gap and voting rights, but I will leave that for, you know, to expand upon that if people are interested in the Q&A. All right. Thank you.
Wonderful. Let's give them a hand. Now, you've been warming up your thinking machines. I know you have. They have been so agreeable. It is your job to be disagreeable. So come and speak, ask questions, anything you want to say. And just raise your hand. Okay, I see a hand all the way in the back there. Back row. Mm-hmm.
Excuse it. Yeah. Hi, thank you all, the entire panel, for being here today. I think it's amazing the wealth of education that's on that stage right now and the experiences. And so you guys coming and talking specifically to young people, I think the majority in this room qualify as young people. That's amazing. And I have a couple of questions, but I'm going to be really concise because I was told to be. Justice Durham, you said that the best way to create change, or in your opinion, the best way to create change is through education, which I think we can all agree that that's a big part of it. You also said that we need to start relying on objective systems and data to make those decisions. So going off of kind of what Mr. Gordon, you said following that, which was that what's happening on the bench like needs to make sure that it doesn't show bias so that when we're interacting with and like creating change for our young people through the justice systems, that maybe that like education or that data is what's making those choices instead of our implicit bias. You said that you you took the Harvard quiz on implicit bias, which you and I are the same in that, and that I was very dismayed when I took it, and it showed preference towards Caucasians. And this is coming from, I taught in public schools in the south side of Chicago for 3 years, and I took it right in the middle of teaching, and I was like, 100% of my students are black, what am I doing here if I have that bias? I had to, after that, work radically to go against that. Not to change it, because my implicit bias is going to be there, but to question everything I do and the decisions I make to make sure that it's not hurting others or perpetuating that systemic bias. So I guess my two-part question, one is for you, Ron, in that what are we actually doing to make sure that that bias isn't there and isn't long-term affecting our young people that go through the justice system? And then overall, if there's anyone who wants to comment, you're talking to a predominantly white institution of mostly young people who, although your experiences are vast and amazing and we so appreciate your information, it's largely inaccessible for us to be able to like say that this thing that's happening in Ferguson or in Chicago or in Boston affects us. So what is it that these students can do now or in the long term, but start now, to actually create change instead of hearing about it and then shutting down on some level because there's nothing that I can really do about it and it's not really touching me?
I know you directed the question at Ron, but I want to say two things. First, about the implicit association test, the IAT, that's been developed at Harvard. There's been some debate about it, and there's some recent research suggesting that results on the IAT do not, there's no causality that's been established between the carrying around of implicit bias and acting in a discriminatory manner. We can, you know, we kind of assume that that happens, but once again, we're assuming perhaps without the solid social science evidence. The second thing I want to say is that one of the things that those of us who've worked in the educational arena have always thought is that if you make people take the IATs and think about implicit bias and do exactly what you described, namely surfacing their own attitudes, being aware that they have those attitudes, and then working in their choices and their actions to be sure that those attitudes are not improperly influencing their outcomes. And I would just like to comment on something. I don't know if Ron knows about this, but there are some experiments going on around the country where judges, trial judges in particular, particularly criminal trial judges, are being asked to start keeping book on themselves, to actually count the kinds of cases they have, the circumstances of those cases, the sentences they impose, and to look at their patterns over time. Once again, trying to surface whether they are, in fact, treating black defendants or black juveniles differently from whites. So just a couple of caveats on the connection between our implicit bias and what we do about it.
Thank you. I appreciate the reminder that implicit bias does not equate with our decisions and our choices and our actions. That's helpful, Claudia. That we know. I guess the good news is there's not a complete correlation, and that means we're empowered. That means we are empowered to, there's hope there. Let me provide a couple of specific examples as to what we are doing to overcome some of these things. So we just passed in Utah historic changes in the juvenile justice system. That comes 2 years after passing historic changes in the adult system. In our juvenile justice system, we see that minority youth are overrepresented at every stage in the process. When you compare the percent of minority youth in Utah to those who are referred to juvenile court, those who are on probation, those who have an out-of-home placement, those who are in secure care, the disparity actually grows throughout the system. So we're doing a few things. One, within my office, we have somebody whose job is to coordinate a disproportionate minority contact office, and that person actually obtains the data on what's going on in Utah, meaning contacts that various people have with juveniles in the juvenile justice system, and then comparing percentages to see if those contacts are disproportionate, taking that information to stakeholders within the system, and then talking about how we can combat these implicit biases that we might have. The legislation that was just passed also mandates certain type of training for stakeholders so that they can become aware that these biases may very well exist, whether implicit or explicit, but then again, how to deal with those. And there are also some very specific changes in statute that are intended to level the playing field. Changes in statute that say an individual can't be referred to juvenile court unless the following have happened. An individual who is adjudicated in juvenile court can't be placed in an out-of-home placement unless the following have happened. It's intended to create some consistency statewide, but also very much intended to level the playing field so that some of those implicit biases might not be reflected in dispositions. Having said that, I also at the same time want to be careful not to suggest that I believe our judges are racist or sexist in the juvenile court. We are simply trying to provide additional tools so that we can have better outcomes, and I think everybody can benefit from those additional tools.
Other questions? All right, I see a hand right down here and then a hand there. So let's go over here to the front row. Yeah.
You can have it first.
Okay. She is seating. Well,
I appreciate that. Thanks very much. I want to reiterate the importance of history in understanding these issues I think that gets lost sometimes. One thing, you know, so I teach economic history, and one thing I emphasize when we talk about these race questions in particular is, you know, you can't sort of take progress for granted. There are certainly periods of retrogression that you can look at where things get worse. It's something I've been thinking a lot about, you know, lately. So that's one reason I think it's important. And the other is with regard to the issue of wealth. If you look at the outcomes that folks have in the labor market, increasingly evidence suggests a lot of that is determined even at the preschool age in terms of resources available to you then, which has a lot to do with your parents' wealth. So I kind of want to invite you to maybe talk a little bit about what you were going to say about wealth on that point.
Yeah, I think one of the most important things that I've seen, I think, in recent decades is a focus less on the wage gap, and but more of a focus holistically about, you know, inequalities in pay across the lifespan and transgenerationally. I mean, that's sort of what the wealth gap is meant to capture, right? This affects, just some brief statistics on that. The wealth gap that I saw just recently was, you know, white households living at the poverty line on average have a net worth of $10,000 to $15,000. That's the sort of wealth savings. And among black households on average, they have a negative net worth, right? When you're comparing two-parent households with children between whites, black, and Latinos, white households hold about 10 times the median net worth of black households and about 8 times the median net worth of Latino households. This is important because wealth is the ability of a household or family to improve and become upwardly mobile, pay for kids' college education, or to weather, you know, downturns in the economy if they lose their job or what have you, right? This is a more holistic measure that sort of thinks about how economic inequality sort of shapes across the lifespan and transgenerationally these disparities, right? There was a recent report issued just, I think, last week that suggested that we are moving towards a racial hereditary aristocracy of wealth. Right? So it sounds like a very sort of inflammatory sort of concept, but this was that was the sort of conclusion of this finding. Thomas Piketty, if you're familiar with him, he's been gaining a lot of attention as an economist on economic inequality. Is one of the sort of authors of this report.
Okay, question right here. Thank you.
I'm Megan Reynolds. I'm in the sociology department with Claudia, or half of Claudia, at least. So I have a question that sort of goes to both of the speakers from our new school of transformation, but I'm interested in any of your thoughts if you'd like to share. So history reminds us, I've kind of written this out so that I don't take too long trying to articulate the roundabout version of it. So history reminds us of things that are important, but it also encourages engagement with ideas that may not reflect our idea of ourselves as people or as a society. For example, the idea of a gender continuum is something that we wouldn't find in history. And one thing as a scholar, but also as a person that I've always kind of wondered about is how do we honor that collective memory and still move forward, make progress, avoid relying on assumptions that ultimately draw from that history. It seems like a very difficult proposition, and I don't expect that there's an answer, one answer, but I'd be interested in your thoughts about possible answers anyway.
Sure, I'll try to take a stab at that. You know, I really appreciated Dr. Stockton's opening sort of anecdote around, example around the bras, right? I think one of the things that gets to your question is we have to be willing to unsettle our assumptions, right? To sort of distance ourselves from ourselves, what's familiar to us. And as Justice Durham was saying, you know, there's a lot of fear involved in that, right? And that we don't want to do that. One of the things that I've been sort of learning recently in my research, I've been focusing a lot on views in early American history about changing labor, right? The changing face of work and labor. And, you know, we often associate industrialization with blue-collar workers, male workers, right? And one of the things I've been sort of discovering now is, well, actually, the origins of industrialization lay with women and dependents, right, through outwork from households who were contracted out to do work in these proto-factories, right? First in the home, but then later on in these on-site factories. This is the origins of the term cottage industry. Right, and so this really is sort of a kind of factoid, if you will, kind of interesting in its own right, that sort of challenges what assumptions we have about work life, right, especially the gendered notion of that. And when you come across this fact like that, then you may then reevaluate American history about what possibilities it opens up for how we think about changing work life down the road. It sort of shows us how, you know, the issues of part-time and some contracted work, especially about for women, that Dr. Geis was talking about, is something that has been a kind of persistent pattern across American history. Right. So,
I'm no historian, but one of the things that I find amazing is that oftentimes, you know, what we think is history is just really just mm-hmm. a sliver, and is what we're mm-hmm. meant to remember. Mm-hmm. It's just, I mean, in my expertise is in gender, but this idea of like what's appropriate for women to like do, say, wear, behave, I mean, all of this is constantly changing over time, and oftentimes people conveniently forget what used to be perfectly normal. Also, we have a very narrow view of like our past, some social definitions in the United States, the way we categorize people in, you know, the gender binary, how we define race as, you know, sort of in different categories in different times, different cultures, and different contexts. Like the, you know, I'm not saying that there is like some secret past where everything was awesome, but like people have like drawn lines along different dimensions, like how we, like their cultures with like more than two genders. Not that, you know, there was no discrimination, but people just thought it was like a matter of fact that there are like multiple categories or different ideas about like what the racial categories are. And so to just like even open up like what we think is the truth from the past can really open us up to a more like broad view of what the future can bring.
But may I add something to that just to kind of make the point even more radical? So I love what's been said so far. But we're talking about constrained choices. These choices are made for children before they can even speak. Talk about the original constrained choice where you have no choice. Is somebody lowering a cone, boy or girl, on your head? And it's your job to get out of that, you know, if that doesn't fit you. And of course, many people have tried to wriggle out of the meanings of those terms. And so the question is, are we best served by continuing the gender binary and allowing so many different opportunities to group on men and women that by the time we're done, nobody can tell the difference between them? Or should we stop making boys and girls to begin with? That would be a sort of more radical way to go. I threw a bomb up at the med school when I asked in the medical environment if somebody could just define a man or a woman. Since we're making them, what are they? And nobody wanted to touch that question. And indeed, I bet if I could x-ray your heads and make you tell me what is a man or a woman, therefore we're going to keep making them, we should know what they are. Why are we making them? And if you say it doesn't make any difference, then why do we feel the difference is so important to mark at birth? So that's where we're constraining choice. And that has tremendous consequences for everything down the line. So are we already working on this problem too far downstream, you know, when the frame has been set? That's an interesting question. How would that work on the front of racialization is a really interesting question. So anyway,
it's, I just want to comment,
I think that's a very profound question and picks up on the theme of national memory. And it's a construct, of course. Our idea of who we are as a nation and what we have been since our founding is very much a construct. And doing history in that regard is a very dangerous undertaking. It will upend our notion of who we have been and who we are. So, for example, when our newly president-elect talked about carnage in this nation, I thought about the Trail of Tears and what this nation did to the Cherokee. And, I mean, you want to talk about carnage, that was carnage, and it was done in the name of the state, and it was done mm-hmm. in the national interest, and it is part of who we were and has to be reconciled with who we think we are and what we want to be. And I apologize because I only read the review of the book. I haven't read the book itself, and I can't even remember the name of it. One of my colleagues will know it. It's a new book about the founders and the degree to which the original founders of this nation utilized the concept of race to marshal support for the new republic by demonizing the other. Originally, it included not just blacks who were enslaved at the time. It also included the German mercenaries, the Hessians. Later on, the Hessians kind of got a pass because they were, after all, white. But it was a deliberate strategy because of the tremendous dissension amongst the original colonies about who was going to have power and how the road to nationhood was going to work, that race was used in a very negative way to build a positive notion about how the revolution was going to develop. I mean, you want to talk about upending your sense of what the framers were all about. We know, of course, that racism and slavery were built into the original Constitution, but reading history is very dangerous, so we need to do it, but we need to be very careful about why we're doing it and what we're going to do with it when we've done it.
Do we have one more question before our lightning round of final? Do you mind? Okay, great. We'll go with one more question here, get another voice in.
I'm a student in the mining engineering department, so this isn't what I usually learn about. And I've had several friends recently change my ideas and start to question what I've thought. So as a person in a very male-dominated field, I have several female friends in my area of study of program, and these women are to deal with problems such as being viewed as weak and not equal to men. What are some of the ways that I can support and help create change in my field and allow for growth and bring new ideas into my field?
Really helpful question. Great. Who would like to?
I'll say something. This won't be the most profound response, but I will say something. You have to speak up. So, and I get that from the fact that Utah's sexual assault rate is the only violent crime that exceeds national averages. So we have really low violent crime in the state of Utah, except for sexual assault. It's really high comparatively. And we are working now within stakeholders regarding the criminal justice system to encourage people to say something. To say something when someone's telling the joke about a woman or making a comment about what they might do at this particular party, even if they intend to do that or not, the point is change is only going to happen if we say something about that and if we call people and help them identify that it's not appropriate. And because too often we think to ourselves, that is way off base. That is not okay. But we just think it. We don't ever verbalize it, so it never gets better.
All right. We are now going to have a lightning round in which you'll see a new brutality from your moderator. This will be 2.5 minutes per speaker. I will tell you when you are done. All right. So, Edmund, shall we begin with you? We'll go the opposite direction this time. And begin.
So, okay, you know, in the interest of cultivating public memory, I just want to sort of leave one thing to consider. You know, this year represents the 50th anniversary of the Kerner Commission. The Kerner Commission was established by the Johnson administration in 1967 in the wake of a number of catastrophic urban riots in L.A., Detroit, Newark, Chicago, in order to understand the causes of these riots and develop recommendations. Released in 1968, the Kerner Report warned that, quote, our nation is moving towards two societies, one white, one black, separate and unequal. The causes of the riots, according to the report, lay in pervasive white racism towards African Americans on the part of the police, its explosive combination with economic deprivation. Certainly from my perspective, we have not learned from history since then, much less learned to cultivate a public memory over those events. mass incarceration, policing practices, the war on drugs, the racial wealth gap, were all significantly instituted or deepened after the Kerner Commission report. So we can't address the collective consequences of our current disparities, much less forestall the fires next time, if we continue to ignore, disavow, or dissemble the lessons of our past. And I want to stress our past, right? Not just someone else's past or someone else's problems, but our past. It has to be cultivated. And we have to act, as Executive Director Gordon suggested.
Wonderful. With 30 seconds to spare, Dr. Barrick, go.
I guess I'm going to elaborate a little bit more on what we can do to address the to reduce the gender wage gap, both in Utah and nationally. Now, a lot of initiatives are actually proceeding at the state level rather than the federal level, so we have now several states that have instituted paid sick leave, for example, to enable women in particular, but also families, essentially workers, to take time off to take care of a sick relative or child. Similarly, paid family leave is really on the uptake in the form of, for example, having a family leave insurance system that people pay into, and so that the burden doesn't fall on employers, because then it would be like employers like, okay, I don't want to bear the cost of this family leave individually, and so this would be spreading the burden, so to speak, across society, and I think basically the rationale for that is that society owes families to support. The support in raising children and balancing how to make a living. And then other issues, so that's sort of the family leave, family-friendly policies component of what we can do. But in addition, there are issues regarding, for example, pay secrecy rules of many employers that have to be broken up. In other words, if you talk to your coworkers and find out about your pay, you are likely to be punished under current rules of many employers. So there's no way you can find out if you're being paid less than a similarly situated coworker. So that has to be another sort of pay transparency.
About 15 seconds
amendment.
To solve the world's problems.
Okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And one final point.
Yes.
I emphasize, so our college education gap, a gender gap between women and men in the state, obviously we need to encourage our young women to pursue and complete college. But and that's going to be important security against, unforeseen circumstances that someone might, essentially fall into and fall into poverty as a result. So it's good that we want to encourage that, but it's not going to help with the gender wage gap unless we address sort of a broader distribution of employment choices and college majors.
Thank you.
One of the things that, in addition to we need all the work family policies, because they do not just benefit women, they benefit people, and if we cannot even agree to that we want to benefit the adults, like, think of the children. At least most of the times people can agree that if things benefit children, maybe we can work across different ideologies. And so a lot of those policies enable people to not lose their livelihoods, not to become homeless, not to lose their employment, and be better parents for their children. Now, I would argue that we also have to care about people who do not have children, but sometimes going via the children is the most conducive to creating change. And anytime you realize that somebody has resistance to providing a safety net, not just for families, but individuals, you have to ask them, well, who do you think is going to take advantage of it? And I think this is where the issue of race comes in, where the idea is like, who's deserving to be protected?
Mm-hmm.
And if people who have the least access to wealth, who are most marginalized, these are the people who would most benefit. If we think that people are not deserving, then we, you know, this is people acting on their biases. The
15 seconds left.
What other point I want to make, if you want to help out, especially for the men and the young men in the audience, one key barrier for women's equality is still inequality at home. So it's not about helping out. It's not about babysitting. It's about being an equal partner in heterosexual relationships so women can be themselves and not just the primary caretaker.
Yay. That was a worthy last 15 seconds, I think we must note. Yes.
Well, I was preparing for this dialogue. I spoke with a lot of my coworkers about the key questions. And there was one discussion I had that was had a particularly big impact on me. I spoke with one of my coworkers who said that he grew up in a different area that had different cultural norms, expectations, and he was taught that when he was in school, students are never to speak. He was very compliant. And he was very diligent in his studies, but also very, very diligent in following the rules. He came to America to continue studies and was marked down by a lot of teachers because he was not engaging. He was not speaking out. He was not participating. It had a big impact on me because I don't know that I ever would have thought of that had he not shared that with me. So it just leads me to an invitation to myself, to everybody, to check your assumptions, to check what you think is appropriate regarding the way that somebody engages in society or in any particular setting where you might be. And I think that can help me go a long way to make sure I don't act on whatever implicit biases I have.
Thank you.
Thank you. I want to endorse particularly the social policy changes that some of my panel colleagues have identified. There's so much that needs doing. If any of you could get to Congress or run for president, do all that good stuff. Like Ron, I would like to bring it down to the personal level. I talked about how painful change can be and how difficult it can be when you are hoping for change. One of the things that we know about it is that people who are being asked to make significant changes in their lives or their thoughts or their worldviews need support. And that goes, I think, to Ron's suggestion that some of that support boils down to respect. It boils down to the willingness as individuals, and I do see many young faces, and I assume many of you are students. I don't think it much matters where you put your efforts, so long as you identify something that you think is important in your view of the world and that requires changing, and set about to do it with the skills that you acquire and with the energy that you have and with the diversity of background and preparation that you bring to it. Thank you.
Wonderful. Professor Button has just asked me to summarize what I've heard today on this panel. I've heard structure and I've heard assumptions. And one thing I think we want to ask ourselves as we leave is how do we build structures to act upon our thoughts? I will tell you, because we have a new school for cultural and social transformation, the goal there was to build a college around gender studies and ethnic studies, not just keep talking about the intersectionality that must come someday, but to say the time has come, we will not stand anymore to just talk about gender in free-floating terms as if it isn't racialized. We will not think of race as not being genderized and having sexuality attached to it. So that was building a structure to actually think about what actions would occur from working on our thoughts. I heard all the panelists talking about assumptions, and one radical challenge to ourselves as we leave here today might be this. What if we said to ourselves, feel free to disagree, that we must not be politically colorblind, a problematic term. We must not be racially colorblind. We must not be gender blind. When people walk through the door, our eyes will assign signs to people if we are sighted people, and many of us on this panel are. That's what we're going to do. We do not blame our eyes, but then the question becomes, how will we not be reduced to our signs? And that's where narrative comes in. That's where what Professor Fong seems profound to me. Then it's game on to find out, how do you live these collections of signs that you have been forced to wear? The very various cones that have been lowered on your head with no choice at all. That includes racialization so profoundly. What does it mean to live as a person who will not be politically colorblind, but will not be reduced to our signs? That's one of the most complicated things to pull off. And that's a challenge that I hear our panel speaking to. Then as we're working inside of that as individuals, moving into narrative with each other, which is endlessly generative. If my job is to get to know your signs, that's a lifelong procedure to get to know how you live these signs. Then the question again becomes structure and structural change. And I think we've heard a number of ideas on that front. We're going to give you evaluation, so don't leave just yet until an evaluation reaches you. But we really want to thank you for your time, your patience, your thoughtfulness, and feel free to be in touch with any of us. Thank you again.
You can find this forum, which looks at race, class, and gender inequities in the U.S., as well as other Hinckley forums, at our website, kcpw.org. This has been another forum in a series of campus community dialogues with the theme of understanding our differences, shaping our future. This program was made possible in part with Hinckley Institute's Wayne Owens Fund. I'm Christian Camargo, your producer and host of this program. Thank you for listening.